Dr. Emily Fraser and her colleagues are the latest group to highlight physiological differences seen in people with long COVID, with research published recently pointing to an antibody signature that could help identify those most at risk. The latest study, which is aiming to recruit 400 participants, is using a specialized magnetic resonance imaging technique in which patients breathe in xenon gas while lying in a scanner. The gas can be traced as it moves from the lungs into the bloodstream, giving a reading of how the lungs are functioning. This contrasts with CT scans, which show just the structure of the lungs. The pilot compared three groups: patients diagnosed with long COVID who have normal CT scans, people who had been hospitalized with COVID more than 3 months previously and were not experiencing long COVID, and a healthy control group. The initial results published on the BioRxiv preprint server show there is significantly impaired gas transfer from the lungs to the bloodstream in these long COVID patients, even when other tests are normal. Similar abnormalities have been detected in COVID patients who had been hospitalized with more severe disease. Professor Fergus Gleeson, a radiologist at Oxford University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust and the study's chief investigator, said, "These patients have never been in hospital and did not have an acute severe illness when they had their COVID-19 infection. Some of them have been experiencing their symptoms for a year after contracting COVID-19. Professor Fergus Gleeson said the team were now hoping to look at what proportion of patients with long COVID have abnormal scans and determine the significance of the abnormality and whether it improves over time. Dr. Emily Fraser said the findings did not undermine the relevance of rehabilitation programs, such as breathing retraining for those with disordered patterns of breathing, for instance. She said, "Rehabilitation strategies are really helpful. We can make progress and set people on the right track, so people shouldn't think I've got lung damage and so there's no point." Dr. Louise Siegfried, a public health specialist at the University of Oxford who was not involved in the research, said the findings highlighted the need for those who had continuing symptoms to be given comprehensive diagnostic assessments. She said, "These early findings are really interesting and in line with other emerging data on lung perfusion defects post-SARS-CoV-2 infection seen in adults as well as adolescents. Furthermore, research by the UK's Office for National Statistics suggests vaccination could reduce the risk of long COVID. The study of more than 6,000 adults found those who were double vaccinated had a 41% lower likelihood of self-reporting COVID symptoms 12 weeks after first testing positive. Overall, 9.5% of the double vaccinated group reported experiencing long COVID, defined as symptoms lasting more than 4 weeks, compared with 14.6% of a socio-demographically matched group who were unvaccinated. Dr. David Strain, a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Exeter Medical School and the British Medical Association's lead on long COVID, said, "The Office of National Statistics findings fitted with research published recently that showed low levels of certain antibodies were more common in those who developed long COVID than in patients who swiftly recovered." He said, "We know that the vaccines trigger these immune responses," adding, "If you approach a COVID infection with high levels of these immunoglobulins, it's less likely to become long COVID." Dr. David Strain noted that it was reassuring that vaccination appeared to mitigate the risk of long COVID. A limitation of the study was that because of the timing of the vaccination program, the double vaccinated participants were sampled at a later time point, 238 days on average, than those in the unvaccinated group. So changes in dominant COVID variants in circulation and other factors that varied over the course of the pandemic could have influenced the results. Study was also observational, and while the two groups were matched for age and other socioeconomic factors, there may have been other differences between the groups, meaning the study could not conclusively prove that vaccination caused the different rates of illness. Separately, the Office of National Statistics found that differences in death rates between people from different ethnic backgrounds have persisted since the start of the vaccination program, with the rate of death involving COVID highest for the Bangladeshi group, 5 times greater than white British group for males, 4.5 times greater for females, followed by the Pakistani group, 3.1 times for males and 2.6 times for females, and black Africans, 2.4 times for males and 1.7 times for females. In most cases, the different rates were explained by where people lived, social disadvantage, occupation, overall health, and vaccination status. However, the Bangladeshi group and Pakistani men remained at higher risk than average even after adjusting for these factors. Previous research highlighted a gene more common in South Asian populations that could place this group at higher risk from COVID. Vahe Nafilyan of the Office of National Statistics said, "Today's analysis shows that since the vaccination program began, the risk of COVID-19 death has continued to be higher in most ethnic minority groups than in the white British group. For the first time, we show that the lower vaccination coverage in some ethnic groups also contributes to the elevated risk of COVID-19 death, particularly in the black African and black Caribbean groups. The latest data from the Office of National Statistics, based on swabs collected from randomly selected households, suggests that COVID infection levels fell in England, also in Wales and Scotland recently, although the trend was unclear in Northern Ireland. The estimate suggests about 2,629,000 people, or about 1 in 20 in England, had COVID in the week ending 22nd of January. The study also shows that while infection levels are falling in most age groups, they are rising in school-age children. Similar findings have been reported in other research, including the REACT-1 study, the latest results of which were released recently by Imperial College London. According to the Office of National Statistics figures for the week ending 22nd of January, the percentage of those testing positive for COVID increased in England among children between the ages of 2 and 6, as well as for those in school year 7 to 11. With almost 12% of the former and more than 6% of the latter testing positive. While some scientists have called for renewed efforts to vaccinate adolescents and expand the program to all children aged 5 and over, others have emphasized that COVID is generally a mild infection for the age group and that there is a tight risk-benefit involved.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the conspiracy theory of love jihad propounded by right-wing Hindu groups against Muslims in India, and how the ban on hijab in Indian schools constitutes a blatant breach of religious freedom. And we shall also take a look at desperate attempts made by the government in Indian-controlled Kashmir to stifle free media and intimidate independent journalists.
The toxic wave of Hindu majoritarianism in India is enabling the world's largest democracy to dangerously slide into anarchy. The invoking of the word jihad by Hindu supremacists to accuse Muslims of spreading COVID-19, of buying Hindu land, and most importantly, of marrying Hindu women, has assumed alarming proportions. Love jihad, as it's called, is a vicious conspiracy theory with historical roots that radical Hindu groups in India used to vilify, harass, attack, and even kill Muslims.
The obnoxious conspiracy theory of Islamic expansionism in Hindu-majority India has its roots in the country's pre-independence history. Right-wing Hindu groups have always sought to fuel any imaginary fear that Hindu women face a threat from Muslim men. In today's times, it has come to be defined as love jihad, a viral social media expression used extensively by the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party leaders and activists to stoke communal tensions and polarize voters. At least four Indian states ruled by the BJP, including the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh, have passed laws criminalizing the so-called love jihad. This theory claims that Muslim men woo Hindu women into wedlock in order to convert them to Islam. The claim is not backed by evidence as corroborated by India's top federal investigative agency and many court rulings. Most recently, in an incident reported from southwestern Karnataka state in September last year, a Muslim man was cruelly killed over an alleged interfaith relationship. The dismembered body of 24-year-old Arbaaz Aftab Mullah was discovered on a stretch of railroad tracks, becoming the latest victim of the so-called love jihad conspiracy theory. The ruling Hindu Nationalist Party in India has been accused of extending overt and covert support to the radical groups targeting Muslim men in the name of love jihad. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence, activists say, amounts to either cowardice or complicity.
More than seven decades after independent India's constitution laid the foundation of a secular republic, the country finds itself at crossroads again. The level of religious bigotry in present-day India can be gauged by the fact that for nearly a month, a government college in southwest India has banned Muslim students from attending classes for wearing hijab. The issue has sparked widespread outcry in India and abroad. School authorities say the ban was enforced to maintain uniformity, but Muslim groups denounce it as a blatant violation of their religious freedom.
On a chilly December morning, seven Muslim students were barred from entering their classroom in southwest India's Karnataka state. Their crime was wearing hijab or the Muslim headscarf. Since December the 31st, the girls have been marked absent from their classes, despite them being present in the college every day. While authorities at the Udupi College, apparently under the pressure of the Bharatiya Janata Party government in the state, have been using pressure tactics to coerce them to cave in, the students have maintained a defiant stance. They say that hijab is a part of their identity and faith, and wearing it is a right guaranteed by the Constitution. As a mark of protest, the students have for the past 4 weeks been sitting on the stairs outside their class, photos of which have gone viral on social media. The protesting students have faced humiliation from school authorities and fellow students, as well as from Hindu radicals for their defiance, but they have refused to give up. The incident has drawn anger and outrage across the country, with Muslim groups accusing the college authorities of prejudice against the minority community. At the same time, radical Hindu politicians have told parents that the ban will remain in place.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Maitreyi Krishnan at the All India Lawyers Association for Justice from Bangalore. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Krishnan. Now, Love Jihad has been described as a vicious conspiracy theory that right-wing Hindu groups in India use to harass and attack Muslims. What's its origin and why has it grabbed headlines in recent years?
Hello, everybody, and thanks, Amin, for having me. When we look at what has been happening insofar as what they call Love Jihad is concerned, this is an attempt to demonize the Muslim community. It is an attempt to to stop any form of actually it is what they are against is love itself, and that's what we have been seeing over the last few years by bringing about this whole language of Love Jihad. One of the main things that they're trying to do is demonize the Muslim community. The other thing that they're doing is to control the freedom of choice, the sexuality of women, and this is something that they've been doing. This is something that they've been speaking of for the last few years, and over a couple of years or so, it's been something that's been talked about a lot more. And one of the things to note is that in Karnataka, there was in fact an investigation that was ordered into it. And the CID in fact found that there's no such thing, and people who are married outside their religion are quite happy. There was an investigation that was done in Kerala, similarly it found the same thing. And if you look at the cases that they speak of as so-called love jihad, and this is in fact a term that we should just also stop using. But if you look at these, what we will see is that these are basically interreligious, interfaith love situation. It's basically couples who married interfaith, which they're giving this name. And this is something that is, and this is a concerted effort to really bring about, to attack this form of interreligious, interfaith relationships that are taking place, at the same time demonize the Muslim community, and it's part of their whole communal agenda to make villains out of Muslims, which is something that we have been seeing.
And Mrs. Krishnan, do you think this so-called love jihad, which has become a viral social media expression, is the creation of the Hindu nationalist BJP government to stoke communal tensions and consolidate its Hindu vote bank?
It is definitely something that has it's a concerted kind of effort that is being made by the by the BJP government. It is part of the Hindutva agenda. One of the biggest challenges that the BJP government faces is situations where there is fraternity, where there is love, or there are relationships between people belonging to different religions, and this is something that is like, it's almost like a challenge to them because it's something that they're so against. So over the last few years, they have been using this language to really attack people who are in these relationships, in any form of interfaith or interreligious relationships. It's also it's something to note that controlling of female sexuality is something that has also been used to maintain the caste system itself, and that's something that has been noted. And it is through this control that the caste system itself has been maintained. And this is now something that is being used to again villainize Muslims, to stoke communal hatred, and to really control women. And this is definitely something this kind of attack against the most basic right to choose, the most basic right to love, is something that they are doing very, very consciously and in an attempt to stoke communal hatred.
Mr. Krishnan, as you know, a 24-year-old Muslim man in the state of Karnataka recently became the latest victim of this conspiracy theory fueled by the unfounded fear of Islamic expansionism. Now, does this point to India's slide into anarchy?
I think the person you're referring to is a young Muslim man, Arbas, who was killed after his hands were tied, his body was mutilated, and he was beheaded for having having had a relationship with a Hindu girl. And for that, he was mutilated, beheaded in this manner. And it is something that was that is extremely concerning. And of course, it points towards the points to what is happening in the country at large. But this is something that we have been saying. In 2015, we had Mr. Akhlaq, who was lynched because he was allegedly he had eaten beef. This happened in Uttar Pradesh. And today, we are seeing a rise in these kind of hate crimes from attacks to murders. That is something that is taking place, and this is certainly something that is extremely concerning.
There you have it, Mrs. Krishnan at the All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Thank you for being on the program, Mrs. Krishnan. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ahmer Khan, an award-winning Indian multimedia journalist, says the rise of Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, in India has seen interfaith marriages becoming a dangerous political flashpoint. New Delhi-based lawyer Kawalpir Kaur hails the Muslim students who were not allowed to enter their classroom in southwestern Karnataka state for wearing hijab as fighters. Nita Parveen, a Kerala-based student activist, slams the decision to ban hijab-wearing Muslim students, says it happens when violence against Muslims is normalized and Islamophobia becomes law.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In a classic case of silencing the messenger and muzzling the voice of free media, a group of pro-government journalists in Indian-controlled Kashmir on January 15th seized the region's only independent press club with the assistance of armed policemen. The state-sponsored takeover of the Kashmir Press Club in broad daylight was denounced by leading journalist bodies and political parties in Kashmir. Stung by a massive outcry, the government later declared the press club defunct, much to the chagrin of journalists.
On January the 15th, as the New Delhi-backed administration in Kashmir had announced a weekend lockdown over the surge in COVID-19 cases, a group of government-backed journalists appeared at the Kashmir Press Club in the region's summer capital, Srinagar. What was widely described as forcible and illegal takeover of the independent media body with 300 journalists as members was a move choreographed by the government, which evoked widespread condemnation. The region's former chief minister, Omar Abdullah, called it a state-sponsored coup. The Editors Guild of India said it was aghast at the manner in which the office and the management of Kashmir Press Club was forcibly taken over and accused the state of being brazenly complicit in this coup. Days after the takeover, the government declared that the only media club in Kashmir had ceased to exist. The largest body of independent journalists in Indian-controlled Kashmir, the club was founded amid much fanfare in 2018. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in 2019, the club was asked to register again as a society. The process encountered multiple hurdles, eventually ending in its overthrow. As one senior club official noted, the only platform that raised the voice against frequent harassment of journalists in Kashmir has now been shut, deregistered, and dispossessed.
The state-backed takeover and the subsequent overthrow of the Kashmir Press Club followed a string of incidents in which local Kashmiri journalists were threatened, harassed, and detained by state agencies on unsubstantiated charges. In the latest case on January 16th, a young Kashmiri journalist, Sajjad Gul, was booked under a draconian law for sharing a video of a Kashmiri family chanting anti-India slogans after their kin was killed by Indian forces. He is not the only one, and certainly not the last.
Since the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi revoked Indian-controlled Kashmir's special status in August 2019, the crackdown on local Kashmiri journalists and independent media groups has intensified. Journalists who have dared to report critically about New Delhi's controversial measures, including the attempts to change the Muslim-majority region's demography, have faced harassment, intimidation, and even imprisonment. Independent journalists in Kashmir continue to walk the tightrope. Dozens of journalists have been subjected to police raids or interrogation or being put on no-fly lists. Some continue to languish behind bars, and many others face serious criminal charges. The crackdown intensified after the government in June 2020 launched a new media policy that authorized the administration to prosecute those spreading fake news. This law has been used as a pretext to muzzle the voice of independent media in the disputed Himalayan region, believe experts. Sajjad Gul's case is a perfect example of how a draconian law like the Public Safety Act has been abused to target journalists for doing their work. The Editors Guild of India says the space for media freedom and civil society is fading in the region. It lists several cases of detention of journalists, including that of Sajjad Gul, Kamran Yusuf, Pirzada Ashiq, Masrat Zahra, Fahad Shah, the killing of senior journalist Shajaat Bukhari.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sanjay Kapoor, the General Secretary of Editors Guild of India. Now, Mr. Kapoor, welcome to the program. What does the takeover and the subsequent overthrow of Kashmir's largest body of independent journalists mean for journalism in the region, and do you see it as an attempt to silence the messenger?
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak on your channel. This is rather distressing what has really happened in Srinagar. Although Srinagar never surprises you, Kashmir never surprises you, because the kind of horror stories that keep on emanating from there, not from the last 7 years, but much longer, ever since, you know, the democracy was stifled and the rule of the gun started dictating terms in that valley. It has been like this. You have journalists who are, being pressured and pushed from two sides, one from the side of the extremists and the other side from the government. So there is not really exactly the freedom of expression or speech that you can really think of. And what has really happened is one more episode of the same saga which has been unfolding for quite a while. So closure of the press club is a phenomenon which we had never heard before. And the fact that it has happened and the authorities have managed to get away with it suggests that such episodes, such happenings can take place anytime, anywhere. There is a point of view which the government authorities have also been presenting for a while. They said that you had all kinds of people who had become members of the press club. They were not journalists, and that allowed a point of view to disseminate from press club, that ideas which are not normally reserved for the media were flowing out of it. They were hinting at the extremists who were using the platform, the press club, to pretty much spread anything they wanted to. But that's not true, because the manner in which the government has intervened, they could have avoided that situation. They could have allowed the two factions within the press club to manage their own affairs. They could have done things in a manner which should have ensured that the government hand is not visible. In this case, the high-handedness of the authorities is so much there that they have not only taken control of the club, they have even taken control of the property. And yesterday or day before, I was seeing the social media that the big hoarding which was put on top of the press club, suggesting it was a Srinagar press club, that was also withdrawn. So they don't want to have any evidence of the fact that this building used to hold the press club, which not only just provide people to come and converse with each other, but also provided a place where journalists could come and work, because Srinagar has been very difficult of late with the where reporting is concerned. Internet shutdown is a very routine thing, so the journalists would come here and find ways to somehow send out the reports. But now this club has gone away. I think one of the places where they used to get support, that has also gone away.
Mr. Kapoor, many national-level media bodies and political parties denounced the move they claimed was backed by the state. So why is the government so afraid of free media in Kashmir?
Government is afraid of free media, not from now, but as I said, there is a past, there's a history to it. It's in a conflict area where you have Pakistan on the other side laying claims on the land for quite a while. This is a legacy of 1947 partition. They think that because it's a majority area of minorities of the Muslims, they are the rightful owner of the land. And there are always competing views that you hear. You have the Indian government and the nationalists who continue to suggest that the point of view which is peddled more or which is accepted more by the Muslims in the valley comes from Pakistan. So in a certain way, the government disputes any point of view coming in from independent media because they think it is flowing in from the neighboring country. So that is why, as I said earlier, the journalists are torn between the two. I mean, there is a feeling that the Indian government is working at cross purposes. They are not really interested in ensuring a democracy in the place because they fear that will be hijacked by elements and people who are not in favor of the state. So time and again, you have the assemblies which have been, they have been thrown out by the centre. That was many, many years ago. Subsequent to that, you had elections which did not get any kind of participation. And now you have a situation where the government of India has done away with the state as such. I mean, the Jammu and Kashmir used to be a combined state, but after August 5th, 2019, the very nature of the state has changed. Although the Home Minister Amit Shah is saying that he will restore the state, but nothing like that is happening. So in a certain way, freedom of free media is something that the government is not even very clear what it would be, because anybody who disputes the narrative is the one that they would distrust most. And at the moment, the government narrative is not acceptable till the time it is forced down.
Mr. Kapoor, as you know, the takeover of the Kashmir Press Club followed many incidents in which local journalists were harassed and detained by government forces. Now, are these strong-arm tactics aimed at controlling the media?
I mean, let's face it, in Kashmir, it's a police state. And democracy deficit has been taking place in practically most of society. There is very little space for free media in many societies which used to swear by democracy, and worse so when you have a conflict situation. So journalists have been picked up. There's so many who have been picked up just for tweeting. Tweet, if you do, has become the enemy of the state as such. If you say something that goes contrary to the point of view represented by the government, then you are being anti-national, and that is the fear that many of us actually experience even in day-to-day life, because you don't know what is the band of the narrative that we can play with. And this has happened in Kashmir more so because that's an area where the government is very, very keen that nothing should get out which goes contrary to the message that they want, and that is where a lot of these journalists end up being on the wrong side of law.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Kapoor, the General Secretary of Editors Guild of India, for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Kashmiri journalist Pirzada Ashraf calls it sad and painful to see Kashmir's only independent press club being sealed. Says it functioned even at the peak of political unrest and the COVID-19 pandemic. Salman Nizami, a Congress party leader, says the armed takeover of Kashmir Press Club undermines institutions and reduces press freedom to a joke in the conflict-marred region. Pro-freedom Kashmiri leader Masroor Ansari cites a news report to assert that journalists in Kashmir have contended with various threats, but their situation has gotten dramatically worse since 2019.
And that was our episode about the rising tide of Islamophobia in BJP-ruled India and also the attempts to throttle the freedom of press in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Thank you for your time, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The regimes that cry that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents, says Jonathan Cook, writer, in an article titled Honest Mistakes: How U.S. and Israeli Regime Justify Targeting and Killing Civilians. Stay tuned for more. Supposedly independent Pentagon inquiry this month claimed just such a good faith mistake after U.S. commanders authorized a drone strike in late August that killed an Afghan family, including seven children. A U.S. Air Force general concluded that there was no negligence or misconduct and that no disciplinary action should be taken. At the weekend, the Pentagon exonerated itself again. It called the 2019 airstrike on Baghouz in Syria that killed dozens of women and children justified. It did so even after an investigation by the New York Times showed that the group of civilians who were bombed had already been identified as fleeing fighting between U.S.-backed militias and Daesh. A U.S. military lawyer, Dean Korsak, flagged the incident at the time as a potential war crime, but the Pentagon never carried out an investigation. It came to public attention only because Korsak sent details to a Senate Oversight Committee. In announcing the conclusions of its Afghanistan inquiry, the Pentagon made clear what its true priorities are in the wake of its hurried Saigon-style exit from Afghanistan following two decades of failed occupation. It cares about image management, not accountability. Contrast its refusal to take action against the drone operators and commanders who fired on a civilian vehicle with the Pentagon's immediate crackdown on one of its troops who criticized the handling of the withdrawal. Veteran Marine Stuart Scheller was court-martialed last month after he used social media to publicly berate his bosses. Which of the two, Scheller's comment or the impunity of those who killed an innocent family, is likely to do more to discredit the role of the U.S. military in Afghanistan or other theaters around the globe in which it operates? The Pentagon is far from alone in expecting to be exempt from scrutiny for its war crimes. The honest mistake is a continuing colonial narrative Western nations tell themselves and the rest of us when they kill civilians. When Western troops invade and occupy other people's lands and maybe help themselves to some of their resources, they find along the way it is done in the name of bringing security or spreading democracy. You're always the good guys, they are the evil ones. We make mistakes, they commit crimes. This is self-righteousness, is the source of Western indignation at any suggestion that the International Criminal Court at The Hague should investigate, let alone prosecute U.S., European, and Israeli regime commanders or politicians for carrying out or overseeing war crimes. The drone operators who killed the family of Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S. aid organization, were authorized to do so because his white Toyota Corolla was mistaken for a similar vehicle reported as belonging to the local franchise of Daesh. But that make is one of the most common vehicles in Afghanistan. The head of the aid organization where he worked told reporters pointedly, "I do not understand how the most powerful military in the world could follow Mr. Ahmadi, an aid worker, in a commonly used car for 8 hours and not figure out who he was and why he was at a U.S. aid organization's headquarters." The decision was at best recklessly indifferent as to whether Ahmadi was a genuine target and whether children would die as a result. But more likely, when it attacked Ahmadi's vehicle, the entire U.S. military system was in the grip of a blinding thirst for revenge. 3 days earlier, 13 American troops and 169 Afghan civilians had been killed when a bomb exploded close to Kabul airport as Afghans master in the hope of gaining a place on one of the last evacuation flights. That airport explosion was the final military humiliation, this one inflicted by Daesh, after the Taliban effectively chased American troops out of Afghanistan. Revenge, even when it is dressed up as restoring deterrence or military honor, is not an honest mistake. But there is an even deeper reason to be skeptical of the Pentagon inquiry. There is no honest mistake defense when the same mistakes keep happening. Honest mistakes can't be a pattern of behavior. And yet the long years of U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq and meddling in Syria have been pockmarked with airstrikes that obliterated families or slammed into wedding parties. That information rarely makes headlines, eclipsed by the Pentagon's earlier faulty claims of successful neutralization of terrorists. But just such mistakes were the reason why the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan ultimately imploded. The Pentagon's scattergun killing of Afghans created so many enemies among the local population that U.S.-backed local rulers lost all legitimacy. Something similar happened during the U.S. and U.K.'s occupation of Iraq. Anyone who believes the Pentagon commits honest mistakes when it kills civilians needs to watch the video, Collateral Murder, issued by WikiLeaks in 2012. It shows the aerial view of helicopter pilots in 2007 as they discuss with a mix of technical indifference and gruesome glee, their missile strikes on a crowd of Iraqis, including two Reuters journalists, moving about on the streets of Baghdad below. When a passing van tries to come to the aid of one of the wounded, the pilots fire again, even though a child is visible in the front seat. In fact, two children were found inside the van. U.S. troops arriving at the scene made the decision to deny both treatment from U.S. physicians. As the pilots were told of the casualties, one commented, "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle." The other responded, "That's right." Before the video was leaked, the military claimed that civilians killed that day had been caught in the crossfire of a gun battle. There is no question that coalition forces were clearly engaged in combat operations against a hostile force, a statement read. The video, however, shows that there was nothing honest or mistaken about the way those Iraqis died, even if there was no specific intention to kill civilians. They were killed because U.S. commanders were uninterested in the safety of those it occupied, because they were indifferent to whether Iraqis, even Iraqi children, lived or died. The The regimes that cry loudest that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents. The Israeli regime's version of this is the tragic mistake. The excuse is used in 2014 when its navy fired two precision missiles at a beach in Gaza at exactly the spot where four boys were playing football. They were killed instantly. In 7 weeks of pummeling Gaza in 2014, the Israeli regime killed more than 500 Palestinian children and more than 850 adult civilians. And yet all were apparently honest mistakes because no troops, commanders or politicians were ever held to account for those deaths. Palestinian civilians keep dying year after year, decade after decade, and yet they are always killed by an honest mistake. The Israeli regime's excuses are entirely unconvincing for the same reason the Pentagon's carry no weight. Both have committed their crimes in another people's territory to which they have not been invited. Both militaries rule over those people without good cause, treating the local population as hostiles, and both act in knowledge that their troops enjoy absolute impunity. In reaching its decision on the killing of the Afghan family this month, the Pentagon stated that it had not broken the law. That verdict, too, is not honest. What the U.S. military means is that it did not break its own self-serving rules of engagement, rules that permit anything the U.S. military decides it wants to do. It behaves if no law applies to it when it invades other lands, not even the laws of territories it occupies. That argument is dishonest, too. There are the laws of war and the laws of occupation. There is international law. The U.S. has broken those laws over and over again in Afghanistan and Iraq, as has the Zionist regime in ruling over the Palestinians for more than five decades and blockading parts of their territory. The problem is that there is no appetite to enforce international law against the planet's sole military superpower and its allies. Instead, it is allowed to claim the role of benevolent global policeman. Both the U.S. and the Israeli regime declined to ratify the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, ICC, that judges war crimes. That refusal was no honest mistake either. Each expected to avoid the court's scrutiny. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders know their troops commit war crimes, and that they themselves commit war crimes by approving either the wars of aggression these troops are expected to wage or the messy, long-term, belligerent occupations they are supposed to enforce. But whatever they hope, the failure to ratify the statute does not serve as a stay-out-of-jail card. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders still risk falling under the ICC's jurisdiction if the countries they invade or occupy have ratified the statute, as is the case with Afghanistan and Palestine. The catch is that the Hague Court can be used only as a last resort. In other words, it has to be shown first that any country accused of war crimes failed to seriously investigate those crimes itself. The chorus from the U.S. and Israeli regime of honest mistake every time they kill civilians is just such proof. It demonstrates that the U.S. and Israeli regime systems are entirely incapable of upholding laws of war or holding their own political and military officials to account. That must be the job of ICC instead. But the court is fearful. The Trump administration launched a war against it last year to stop its officials investigating U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The assets of the court's officials were blocked and they were denied the right to enter the U.S. That is the reason why the court keeps failing to stand up for the victims of Western war crimes like Zimari Ahmadi and his children. The ICC had spent 15 years dragging its feet before it finally announced last year that it would investigate allegations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. That resolve quickly dissolved under the subsequent campaign of pressure. In September, shortly after Ahmadi's family was killed by U.S. drone operators, the court's chief prosecutor declared that investigations into U.S. actions in Afghanistan including widespread claims of torture of Afghans, would be deprioritized. The investigation would focus instead on Taliban and Daesh. Once again, enemies of the United States, but not the United States itself, will be called to account. That, too, is no honest mistake. Economic divide.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi just wrapped up his two-day visit to Russia, and what a visit it was. He said that Iran and Russia have reached fundamental agreements on expanding ties. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahlai, and in this edition of the program, we will look at what these fundamental agreements are in the expansion of ties, especially in the economic sphere. Now, some of the highlights coming up in today's program: how to challenge dominance and continue trade in their national currencies, especially when it comes to oil, with a promise to increase bilateral trade from the current $3 billion to $10 billion. We'll also take a look at a very important agreement, the 20-year cooperation roadmap. It will be worked on by both nations, first the Chinese 25-year agreement, and now this. We ask, will this be enough to challenge sanctions? Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani has a surprise answer on that. And in what is a first, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's address to the Russian lower house of parliament, the Duma. You don't want to miss those highlights. He said, among other things, the U.S. uses the dollar as a weapon. All coming up.
It was a trip that was hailed as a success. The two-day visit of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to Russia at the personal invitation of the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
We can promote our relations in the economy, trade, on the political track, and in all these spheres. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have no restrictions, and nothing holds us back from further developing our ties with friendly Russia.
Vladimir Putin also had kind words for him.
I would like to note that despite the pandemic, even last year, we saw a slight increase in trade.
He even addressed the State Duma, Russia's lower house of parliament.
Sanctioning nations is a common form of new domination, and countering it requires cooperation of sovereign states and a collective response. Otherwise, sanctions will affect all countries, even U.S. allies, under various pretexts.
Iran's president said that a visit to Russia could be a turning point in political, trade, and economic relations between the two countries. The U.S. weaponization of the dollar was a key topic of discussion, which he said the two sides discussed steps to challenge the dominance of the U.S. dollar and to continue trade in their national currencies.
The main principle is that we do not want to gain dominance over other countries and are not ready to be dominated by other countries. This is the principle. One shouldn't oppress others and shouldn't be suppressed by other countries.
Iran's economy minister was also optimistic about the outcome of the trip. Meanwhile, the foreign ministers of both countries announced that they were set to update the 20-year cooperation treaty that they had signed in 2001.
We have this strategic document in the making, aimed for a 20-year perspective. It is a comprehensive document. It includes all areas of cooperation, and it can determine the prospects for all participants in economic and market activities in the field of technology, defense, and so on.
One outcome of this trip has been Iran's and Russia's efforts to complete the North-South Corridor.
Cooperation is in the framework of the two main international transport routes, which are North-South and South-West, offers great opportunities for both countries.
This is a rail route in Iran that would be integrated into the International North-South Transport Corridor, NSTC, a multimodal route linking India and the Persian Gulf to Europe. This is a major international route, which they said is of great economic significance for both Iran and Russia.
When the Iranian president touched down in Russia, it was not exactly known what would happen in terms of his meeting with the Russian president or in areas like trade. First, his meeting with the Russian president drew a lot of social media reactions. For example, this picture, the Iranian president Ebrahim Raisi seen here praying at the Kremlin while on his state visit. Now, the Russian president, based on the Russian Federation official website, noted how, despite the pandemic, he said, we increased trade even the year before last. This increase was not big, over 6%, but was still an increase. Last year, however, trade grew by more than 38%. We are carrying out major projects in many areas. Now, one way of increasing trade is what the Russian president noted to Iran's President Raisi, that Iran and the EAEU are developing relations on a temporary basis under a temporary agreement. It added, we are doing much to create a long-term foundation for cooperation and a free trade area between Iran and our union. Now it's time for our definition check. What is the Eurasian Economic Union? Well, it came into effect in the year 2015, and it consists of five countries, Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Russia, with the aim of fostering closer economic cooperation among the member states for the well-being of the people of the region. Now, noted columnist and writer Pepe Escobar on Eurasian integration tweeted, this visit by Ebrahim Raisi, which I am making at the invitation of Vladimir Putin, could be a turning point in Iran's political, economic, and trade relations with Russia. They meet later today in Sochi. Eurasia integration rolling. And this is what the U.S. gets when it pushes countries that it sees as its adversaries for not following its line. With the U.S. and allies' expansionism policy in full flow, Russia, China, and Iran should start a real multilateral movement to include same-minded states to oppose them on all fronts. This movement should be constructed on mutually beneficiary policies. But when it comes to the U.S. weaponization of sanctions, which, let's be real, the dollar is a major part of it, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Dr. Ali Shamkhani, had this to say about U.S. sanctions when it came to Iran's oil. He said Iran's oil trading and its financial affairs has reached appropriate and irreversible conditions. It is not possible to promise to lift a sanction that has become ineffective in order to score a point. He followed that with a hashtag by the name of active resistance. And then this tweet came about by China, which was also very telling in terms of the timing. China announced that it would put 4 million barrels of Iranian oil into state reserves despite U.S. sanctions. Okay, joining us in this segment, we have two guests. First, we have a guest in our studio, Ruhula Mudaber, joins us. It's a pleasure having you. You are an expert on Eurasia and Russian Federation affairs. Thanks for joining us here in the studios. We also have with us Dmitry Babich. He is a radio host and political commentator. I'm going to first start with you, Dmitry Babich, and get a reflection from you on the Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. He has said three things as top priorities. Quote, a neighbor-centered policy, an Asia-centered policy with a focus on looking to the East, and an economy-centered diplomacy. Now, both Iran and Russia are redoubling their efforts in their relationship, with Iran having this stance. In terms of the two, how do you think that will contribute to one of their goals, de-dollarization?
De-dollarization is a requirement of the day. It is clear that reliance on the dollar, when the United States is basically behaving very irrationally under Trump or without Trump, the United States is behaving more and more irrationally. So the fact that we have to be dependent on its currency is very dangerous, you know. Independent of who is in charge right now in Washington, it's dangerous now to be dependent on the American currency.
Our guest there talked about what I led and into, and that was de-dollarization. Iran has the focus centered now towards the east. The top three priorities, according to the Iranian foreign minister, a neighbor-centered policy, an Asia-centered policy with a focus on looking to the east. Tell us how this union between Russia and Iran in particular will lead to de-dollarization, which our guests there confirmed.
Hello, I would like to extend my warmest welcome. The foreign policy of Iran's 13th administration is based on honor, wisdom, and diplomacy with its counterparts, and it has been approved by Iran's leader. There is a special consideration and attention given to jump-starting economy.